This podcast is part of the London Business School series, Inside the Global Economy, in which leading experts explore what is really going on in the global economy today.
Hello, all. I am Richard Portis, Professor of Economics at London Business School, and I welcome you to a series of podcasts in which we discuss how financial services are changing in a world of ultra-low interest rates, rising competition, and continued regulatory pressures. It's part of Inside the Global Economy. I have with me as my guest Jean-Pierre Mustier, the CEO of UniCredit, the largest Italian bank. This conversation is on the record, evidently, but I should say as a disclaimer that I'm on various committees and so forth of the European Systemic Risk Board, the Macroprudential Authority, and none of what I say should be in any way attributed to them. So let's go, Jean-Pierre. I would start with a structural issue. 5 years ago, it is already, the committee that I chair at European Systemic Risk Board published a report on overbanking in Europe, maintaining that there was excess capacity in the banking sector, it needed rationalization, and so on. You're familiar with the issues. But if you agree with that assessment, still, after all, things have changed in the past 5 years, but if that is still an accurate assessment, how could we encourage consolidation in the European banking sector?
Hello, Richard. First of all, we need to define exactly what overbanking means, and we need to see whether or not there is an alternative to banks in Europe. There has been, from time to time, comments about Europe becoming like the US and capital market replacing banks, basically. I don't think it will happen. In other words, when we look at the size of our small and mid-sized companies, SMEs, they need banks. They are too small to go to the capital market, and they need banks because their financing are usually short-term financing, like working capital financing or small ticket leasing, or amortizing loan that a bond market does not provide. So as such, we need banks in Europe which cover all the SMEs. Of course, the retail clients, but the coverage of SMEs is important because we don't have any alternative. In countries like Germany or Italy, where UniCredit is present, we are the largest Italian bank by balance sheet size. And we are the third private German bank in Germany with Hypovereins Bank. These two countries are very fragmented. And so the SMEs are all over the country. At the opposite of the UK or France, which are countries which are much more concentrated around a few big cities. So the bank coverage needs to be more fragmented. And we probably need a higher number of banks or branches than what we have in other countries. But nevertheless, you're right to say that we have a certain number of smaller banks, which might not have today the critical size to be able to handle the different requirements which are coming with the banking sector, with higher need to deal with regulatory issues like anti-money laundering, new client, and a higher need as well to develop a certain number of digital offer which require a minimum critical size. So we will need for these banks to reach minimum critical size, which means that they need to get together, probably more on a domestic basis than on a pan-European basis, but I'll come back to that.
Yes, I think we should come back to that.
Yes, but what does it mean, banking consolidation? It means that if you put two banks together, it's to reach bigger critical size, but it's as well to optimize the cost base. So you need to cut cost. When the banks are much bigger and get together, you will need as well probably higher capital requirement because of the regulation. If you look at the global systemic institution, the GCF, you might jump a GCF buffer in our jargon, meaning that you can have an additional capital requirement. So whether you have provision for restructuring, which means higher capital requirement because you have a negative income, or higher capital buffer needed, you need more capital. And usually, smaller banks are short of capital. And for them to get together with somebody else, if you put two banks which are short of capital, you have a bigger bank which is probably even shorter of capital because they take the provision for restructuring. So that is not the solution today. And if you put two big banks together, they need to have access to more capital because of the regulatory buffer, because of the restructuring cost. And today, where bigger banks are trading at a very sharp discount to tangible book, if you raise capital at such a low level, it is extremely dilutive. So you take integration risk for not much progress. So as such, I think that's why in an environment where combination, domestic or pan-European, are actually very difficult because the banks will have to raise capital at a depressed valuation level. And so we need to see an improvement. And the depressed valuation level, if we go back to our first question, can be coming in part because we have a negative rate environment, which itself is probably due to the fact that we have low growth in Europe. So it will be difficult, I think, to see more consolidation in the coming years for the reason I mentioned. And we probably need to see first an improvement on the share price of banks before seeing any kind of evolution.
That's very helpful. Let me switch to another, to a partly regulatory issue, which is the so-called banking union. We have this single supervisory mechanism. We have the single resolution mechanism, which might be called upon if a bank is failing. But we don't have a European deposit insurance scheme. Do we really need a European-level deposit insurance scheme?
No, I don't think it is needed. UniCredit is one of the very few pan-European banks. We have presence in Italy. We are the largest bank in terms of balance sheet, the third largest private bank in Germany, the first bank in Austria with Bank Austria. And we are the largest CEE bank on a consolidated basis when you look at all our presence. So we are present in 14 different countries. That's what I call pan-European. And a lot of these countries are within the EU. Why would I need to operate UniCredit, a common deposit insurance scheme? Well, people say I can use the deposit I have in Germany to finance maybe my clients in Italy. Would I do that? No. Why? Because if I use my German euros to finance my Italian loan, my German funding curve will become an Italian funding curve, which means that I will be uncompetitive with my German client. And so I need to make sure I manage for all my subsidiaries, a balanced asset and liability. And so I balance my asset and liability in Germany. I balance my asset and liability in Italy. This is the best way for me to optimize my setup. And so the European Deposit Insurance Scheme will not bring me anything. So why do we need a banking union? And that is an important question. And the answer is we need a European banking sector. When I go and meet investors in the US, they don't tell me I invest in the bank of the state of New York or I invest in the bank of the state of California. They tell me I invest in an American bank. The same investors, when they look at Europe, invest in a German bank, an Italian bank, a French bank, because they don't see European banks as European. Why? Because despite the very good progress done by the single supervisor, we don't have yet a European banking sector which is seen as homogeneous by the investors. And why is it important? It is important because we need more capacity in Europe to invest in the capital of banks, the capital structure of banks, equity or bonds. I raised at the end of last year, December 2018, $3 billion of specific bond called senior non-preferred. And I was prevented because I had privileged information about some aspect of the bank to do that before end of November. So I had only 2 weeks to raise $3 billion. Could I raise $3 billion in the euro market? No. The euro market is not deep enough. So I went to the US and did a private placement with one very large institution for a ticket of $3 billion. The euro market is not deep enough for a senior non-preferred bond, which is a very plain vanilla type of transaction. So we need a banking union to make sure that banks can do large transactions on their balance sheet structure to refinance themselves. If European banks can access to capital at a more liquid and tighter spread, then they can on lend to their client at more attractive terms. So the banking union should be extremely important to make sure that we see the banks as European banks. And so for that, we need more regulation. What do I mean by that? I need that we need less directive, which when they are decided, are adjusted for the benefits of each country, which make the banks much less comparable, basically. And so more regulation, which are imposed on everybody in the same way, will make the sector much more homogeneous, much more attractive for investors, because what you see is what you get. And today, it is difficult for an investor to see exactly the same thing in different countries. So the banking union is important for that and is, as such, very much connected to the capital market union as well. We need to attract more capital in Europe to finance banks, but also to finance SMEs, which needs more capital for their growth. So the capital market union will be extremely important in its second version. And I have to say that the commission for the capital market union looked at the issuer, but didn't look at the investor side. And capital markets are made of issuer on one side, but as importantly, and I would say even more importantly, made of investors. And so we need to look at both.
Let me switch to weaknesses of European banks, in particular the low return on equity and the fact that that in many cases is less than the cost of capital for the banks. What brings this about? What are the weaknesses of the banks? Is it high cost ratios? Is it non-performing loans? What's going on here? Is it competition from the new innovative banks that have potentially lower costs? Is it the regulatory environment? What are the structural problems?
Well, for auditors, I would advise them to read the letter of Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, chairman and CEO of JP Morgan, to his shareholders. He published that every year. It's a very interesting reading. First of all, he is a very clever person and writes very well. But when you read what he's writing about, you feel he's living in a completely different world compared to Europe. So you can see in the US, a world where they have positive interest rate, a steeper yield curve, and growth, in an environment which is to a large extent, an oligopoly. That's not good for the consumer. Why do I mean an oligopoly? If you look at fees paid by U.S. clients of U.S. banks, for instance, on capital market, they are on average 2 to 3 times higher than what we have in Europe. So clearly, in Europe, the consumer or the client of the bank benefit from more competition, which is a combination of domestic bank and international bank entering each of the market. So yes, we have more competition, but it benefits the consumers or the clients of the bank, so that should be good. Then we have lower growth, and clearly when you have lower growth, I mean, you make less profit because you have less client activity. And then we have negative rates, which are a consequence of lower growth, which makes the profitability of banks much lower. When I look at UniCredit, at the difference of profitability between our banks in the CEE side, which are not in the Eurozone, in countries which grow. Let's go take Hungary, let's take Bulgaria, let's take the Czech Republic and others. The return on equity on my banks is very high. It's well into the double digit and much higher than their cost of capital. When I'm saying much higher, we're speaking about 3, 4, 5, up to 10% above their cost of capital. So within Europe, when you go outside of the Eurozone, you still can find banks which have a very, very decent profitability and which grow. So I think the competition in Europe, combined with the negative rate and combined with the ever-increasing regulatory requirement, makes European bank less profitable and less competitive, and that's the issue we have. And I think Europe has probably not negotiated in the best way one of the last regulatory changes which should happen, the so-called Basel IV, which is the completion of the Basel III. There was a very recent study done by the European Banking Authority, which is the regulator of the regulator to a certain extent, which looked at the impact of Basel IV for European banks and specifically for global SIFI. The capital requirement coming for Basel IV for global SIFI, for the 8 largest global SIFI in Europe, the additional capital requirement is 28% of the total capital of the bank. That's massive. The additional capital requirement for US bank with Basel IV is 5%. 5%, 28%. You can see that it is not a level playing field. So to a certain extent, we are shooting ourselves in the foot. One can say not at all, because if we have more regulation, higher capital requirement for European banks, then their cost of equity should go down because they are safer, which could be a counter-argument, which is partially true. But the fact is, if your profitability goes down, it is not quite sure that your cost of capital will go down even if you have more capital. And so as such, I think we are today in Europe in a combination, in a perfect storm, if you want. Low growth, negative rate, more capital requirement, which makes banks less profitable. What is the way out? Well, on one side, it is to try to have decent revenues, but be careful not to put risk you don't want to have in your balance sheet, because if you go for volume growth, for instance, you know, you might pay that back in the future by having more provision. Then control cost can be cost reduction, like we did at UniCredit for our current plan, or cost moderation. And then you deliver a return on equity, which needs to be stable, and quarter after quarter, so that the perception of the market of the bank will be a bank with a decent balance sheet, good capital level, stable earnings, so you become more utility. Then your cost of equity can go down, and then your share price can perform accordingly. But you can see that it is a very fine way of managing the bank. You mentioned competition coming from the new banks, the fintech or others. I mean, others meaning the large GAFA with Apple Pay and others. I don't think it's an issue for banks today. First of all, the fintech, if I'm a bit provocative, have no clients and no capital. So for them to grow, it's a little bit of an issue. And if they acquire clients, they lose money, because they do that by buying client, by offering product which are more or less free. Is it a sustainable business model when you're a financial institution to keep losing money? The answer is probably no. Do you want, as a client of the bank, to put your savings into an institution which is losing money every year and which has to recapitalize? No. We as a bank benefit from a tremendous advantage, which is that there is no copyright on financial product. So if a fintech has a good idea, I can either ask them to provide it as a white label, which we do at UniCredit, or I can copy their idea. Why? Because there's no copyright. And then at UniCredit, we have 26 million clients and 50 billion of capital. So not only can I copy very fast, but I have the capital and the client in order to deploy everything. So I think the fintech are actually a good motivation for the bank to keep awake, be on their toes, offer a better product to the client, cooperate with the fintech, and that's absolutely fine. With the GAFA today, we see very little impact. We actually are willing to cannibalize our business model. We were the first one to offer Apple Pay in Italy. We had exclusivity. And it brought us actually much more acquiring business, in a sense that acquiring is the point of sales you put in the shop. Because we were the only one to have Apple Pay, all the shops wanted to have our own point of sales in order to serve their client. So we increase our acquiring business meaningfully. So you can see that if you, quote unquote, cannibalize your business model, you can nevertheless can benefit of it. What will be the big risk for the GAFA is to move into the Chinese model in the Alibaba, Alipay or Tencent type of environment, where you have platforms which are more or less closed and where the client, once hooked up, cannot exist. And then it's become a very, very strong competitor. But we're very, very far from that in Europe. So I'm not worried about such an evolution. And I think for European bank, the fintechs are more an opportunity rather than a threat. And the issue for us is to work on a very, a very serious and disciplined way about our income, our risk, our cost, and optimize our processes.
Let's shift to a topic that's very close to my heart, because I'm co-chair also of the European Systemic Risk Board Committee on what used to be called shadow banking. We now call it non-bank financial intermediation. And the issues here, some of the issues, are bank exposures to non-banks, to shadow banks, their loans to asset managers, the step-in risk if they control or have a relationship with an asset manager that gets into trouble, the loans that they are making more and more to private equity and to ETFs and mutual funds that buy leveraged loans. Are these things that you think we should be concerned about? And in particular, is there any reason for the regulators to act on these issues?
Well, starting with your last point, I think the regulator should act if there is a systemic risk. Otherwise, there's no reason for the regulator to act. And so when the funds are not leveraged and are just replacing banks in order to provide debt, for instance, well, the investor into the fund might lose their investment, but it's not creating a systemic risk. So I think that the question is really, you know, should regulator act to regulate more leverage funds? And which kind of leverage funds could you have? You could have CLOs. And then the CLO are, you know, to a certain extent regulated by the rating agencies, which define, you know, very constraining investment guidelines for the CLO manager, which is usually an asset manager. So I think the CLO are not representing a systemic issue, but from time to time can represent a small shock to the system.
Might there not be a systemic risk from asset managers that take positions that are involved a very substantial degree of maturity transformation? For example, open-ended real estate funds.
Yeah, I'm coming to that. I'm coming to that. So I think on the leveraged finance side, as you mentioned, the asset class, the real risk is not coming directly from, you know, traditional asset managers, but it's more coming from private equity company, which put capital at risk, so they might lose it, and banks, which provide the leverage on a given company. And we have seen the leverage ratio going up, the debt-to-equity ratio going up meaningfully in the past few years. I used to manage a leverage loan fund before coming back to UniCredit and CLO. So, you know, when I was managing my fund, we were at a leverage of three and a half times. Today, you know, it's not uncommon to see well above six times leverage. So you can see that, you know, the leverage on a given credit can be much higher with less covenant and with much lower rate, which means that if ever the rates were to go up, which I don't think will happen in the future, I mean, the interest charge for the borrower will increase meaningfully. And if you're very leveraged, it can be lethal. So I think we have today the necessity for the banks to be extremely careful on their leveraged loan portfolio. And the ECB, for instance, is asking the bank management to give attention to any transaction above six times leverage. So I actually review all the credit risk for leverage loans which are above six times leverage, which means that we don't have many because nobody wants to bring me a credit file with more than six times leverage. So there is some kind of self-discipline. But by and large, when I look at the quote-unquote shadow banking, I am not too worried today about the implied leverage which is in the system because it is well known. We had in the past, in 2008, the liquidity risk and indirectly then the, you know, the credit risk, you know, was not extremely well understood neither by the bank or by the regulator. I think these issues are from the past, and I'm comfortable that the shadow banking does not represent a major risk for the system, with the proviso of course, you know, maybe some tension on leveraged loan in the future.
Let's switch again to a topic that is close to my heart, which is macroprudential regulation and the macroprudential regulation as applied to banks. One area of that is the so-called countercyclical capital buffer. And you were talking about capital ratios. The idea here is that the regulator will require from the banks to add to their capital base in order that they may, first of all, that might damp down a credit expansion that seems to be going too far, or it might create a reserve that could then be brought down, drawn upon, if there's a downward move. And the thing is that the banks have been very hostile to this. If you look at France, for example, there was a huge outcry when the French regulator said, we're going to raise the countercyclical capital buffer from 0 to 0.25%, 25 basis points. What do you think about these, about the CCYB?
I think you're raising various issues here. One is we have a lot of additional capital requirement. And, you know, one can say that if we have more capital, banks are going to be less risky, their cost of capital can go down, and everybody should be happy. The only thing is, we don't have today a proper view of the combined impact of all the regulatory requirements. Why? Because we have a different institution which are working together in order to increase them. The Basel Committee, the EBA, the ECB, and the domestic regulators. And so, of course, 25 basis points taken in isolation, you can say, well, it's only 25 basis points. But when it comes from three other regulators who are saying, another 25 basis points, it is not much, at the end, you are at 100 basis points. So what is important to do is to look at the combined impact of all regulatory changes. I go back to what I said earlier about Basel IV and the impact study which were made by the EBA on the impact of Basel IV on global SIFI. Until then, the Commission was saying Basel IV is going to be non-significant in terms of impact of capital on the European bank. It was repeated by the commissioner in charge and by various members of the Commission. If a 28% increase of regulatory capital requirement is non-significant, I don't know what is significant. So each individual measure makes a lot of sense. Afterwards is to see whether all the measures put together are in fact overlapping or are creating a requirement which could be counterproductive, if not countercyclical. The second thing is on countercyclical buffer. Experience have shown that when a regulator asks for more capital, they very rarely give it back. So you know that if you have a 25 basis point more, if we have a downturn, would the regulator in a crisis say, ha-ha, you have a countercyclical buffer, I move it down to zero?
We did it here.
Well,
we did it in the UK.
The British are pragmatic. I'm not quite sure that the European, continental Europeans are as much, actually. So I think there's a feeling of banks that when the regulator asks for something more, he never gives it back. But, you know, more importantly, I think, you know, banks will always complain if you ask for more capital requirements. And if I may say, that's the normal tension. So my point is not about that. My point is about to say, let's make sure that we have this proper impact study to look at all the impact. We at UniCredit did what we call a capital market day, which meant we made a presentation to investors in December 2017. And I asked the team to look at the impact of all regulatory requirements which were to come between December 2017 and 27, so 10 years. Because we have EBA guidelines, we have Basel IV, we have the FRTB, we have the calendar provisioning. So you have a lot of additional capital requirements. And it was for us an increase, 470 basis points. So that's quite a lot, actually. When I went to see the regulator, I said, do you know what is the combined impact? They said, no. I said, well, it's 470. No, it's not possible. I said, yes, it is possible because I made the calculation and look at it. Say, ah, we need an impact study. And I think this is what we need, the regulators, because the problem we have in Europe is that we have too many regulators and we have to a certain extent a race for each of them to say we need to add something. And so what we would need is, you know, to make sure we have one of them to look at the combined impact and to see if all the additional requirements are consistent and making sense.
That I'm totally in favor of, and it's amazing that the regulators haven't taken the initiative to do that. Let's have one final question, because I think we are running out of time, but it's a big one, and it's particularly big, I may say, in Italy. It's what we call the bank-sovereign nexus, or the diabolic loop, the idea being that banks hold a lot of their own sovereign's debt. If the sovereign gets in trouble, their balance sheets deteriorate. If their balance sheets deteriorate, the markets may think that the government will have to step in, so the fiscal position of the government comes into question. That raises interest rates that the government is paying on its debt, and that then has an impact on the values of the bonds that the banks are holding, and it can go in a vicious circle. Do you think that that's a danger today, or have we passed it?
Well, it is an important question because we need in a currency union to see how banks can manage their liquidity. And clearly, when a sovereign is raising money in a currency which is not its own currency, would say that euro might not be the, you know, domestic currency each of the sovereign. I mean, you might have a disconnect, basically, which means that there could be a quote-unquote risk that at least the sovereign could have a higher probability of default, which negatively impact its spread. So we are looking very, very seriously at our balance sheet, make sure that we improve our balance sheet profile. And part of that is managing our bond portfolio. But what are the solutions from a regulatory point of view? Is it to create capital charge on bond holdings by banks? That could create a problem because, what is the reference rate, the risk-free rate, basically, if you're in a given country, if the bonds of your country have a capital charge versus another one? Should it be, which I think could make more sense, going back to something which is back to reality, limiting the leverage. So in other words, to have a maximum exposure allowed for the banks as a portion of their equity. And beyond that, banks could be penalized from higher capital requirements. And beyond a certain level, it's not liquidity management anymore, but it is a more speculation, if I may say. But, we have a problem today of diversification in Europe. So I think we need to look at it seriously. I agree that it is important to limit the leverage. And I think that it's probably first a leverage impact and then a capital charge above a certain leverage, which probably would make sense. So it's a tiered approach to the sovereign holding, which is probably the most pragmatic approach.
Well, I think we probably should come to an end. Our time has run out. And I should just say that I'm very grateful, we are very grateful, that you've given us your time and your insights. I have certainly learned a lot. And I'm sure that those listening to this podcast will have learned a great deal. And the overall clarity of your exposition was remarkable. And the depth that you went into was remarkable. So we are very grateful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Richard. It's always a pleasure and an honor to have a discussion with you. Thank you.
This was a London Business School podcast, bringing you fresh insights and ideas from London Business School's experts. To listen and read more, visit www.london.edu.